The global pandemic is giving us a Dickensian moment. It's the best of times because we've got a vaccine against COVID-19. And it's the worst of times because not everyone has access to it. This from Dr. Larry Brilliant, one of the most respected epidemiologists in the world. He was on the WHO team that eradicated smallpox, one of the great medical achievements in history. He's the founder and CEO of Pan Defence Advisory, a pandemic response consultancy. He says herd immunity is a fantasy, but there is a vaccination strategy that can help save lives and contain outbreaks. Dr. Larry Brilliant joins me now. Hello there.
Jesse, very nice to talk to you. And isn't it fun to have the word Dickensian that we can use? I don't think I ever used it before the pandemic. I thought it might have been Dickensonian.
Dickens-esque. Well, speaking of words, I was going to ask you this later, but I'll just come out and say it. Did you know that you were destined for great things when you found out your name was Larry Brilliant?
My name is very good for me on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, but Tuesdays and Thursdays, not so much. If you do good things, it's a accelerator. But when you mess up, it's really the pits. let's go to that other word that you used, fantasy. Herd immunity is, I think it's more like a in math, what they call an asymptote, two numbers that are always trying to reach the same place but never quite reach, almost like Sisyphus, always pushing up that rock, or the Greek legend of Tantalus. He's in a pit and they're giving him grapes, and every time he reaches for the grapes, they pull it away. The reason that we'll never get to herd immunity is multiple, but there's an absolute disqualifier for ever thinking of herd immunity when you can't tell which herd it is that we're speaking about. We're normally thinking about the human herd, but this virus has already infected 12 other herds, animals from great apes to bats that we know about, to mice and chimpanzees and all the big cats, the lions, the tigers. When you have a virus that is in both humans and in animals and that it spreads back and forth, as we have an unfortunate example in Holland or in Denmark, where over 200 people were infected by dealing with minks. And the minks, of course, had been infected by humans. Once you have that kind of viral chatter, as we call it, it's hard to know what herd immunity means, because it's usually a percentage of the people who could carry the virus who are no longer susceptible because they've been vaccinated or because they've had the disease. It's hard to know what the denominator is when people can constantly get the disease back and forth from animals. And in addition, when I used to teach epidemiology, we used to always say that a virus or a disease is not a candidate for herd immunity so long as it continues to make variants. And that each of those variants can also infect people. So even the concept of herd immunity is fraught. But more than that, you'd have to be able to vaccinate 90% of humanity, and we're so far away from that.
Yeah. It's interesting. Our Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has resisted the temptation to give us a number, to say we're aiming for this number. Other commentators have said we should go for 90%. Some epidemiologists have said more than 90%. I'm talking about the numbers of people double dosed. What is your view on whether there should be a public level that we are targeting and aiming for?
Well, first of all, I don't want to get involved in New Zealand politics because I don't know anything about New Zealand politics, but I think your prime minister is a hero and a great example of how to do things right. So I'm just going to state that. But, you know, the thing is, we have, and I gave you some technical, you know, kind of academic reasons why we can't reach herd immunity, and then the practical reason which is that over 100 countries have less than 5% of their population vaccinated. We have such an unequal and inequitable distribution of vaccines right now. We're a long way away from reaching any of those numbers, whether it's 65 or 85 or 90%. But I would say this. When the original virus came from Wuhan in China, at that time, the calculations of what the transmissibility number was, this R-naught that we use, that was at that time, that, and that's a measure of how many second cases arise from the first case. That's a simple number. One case leads to two, your R-naught is two. One case leads to 10, the R-naught is 10. So the first variant, the original, the ancestral strain, the R-naught was about three. One case would lead to three. In the case of Delta, the R-naught is eight. One case leads to eight. So just think about that herd immunity is a formula where if one case leads to three, then you need 67% or 75%, depending on how you count it, of people vaccinated. If one case leads to 10, you need 90% of people vaccinated. But there's even another issue, and stop me if I'm too wonky, but in the case of chickenpox and measles, which is often compared to COVID, the Delta variant, one case leads to 10, but it takes 2 weeks of an incubation period for one case to go to 10.
Right.
In the case of the Delta, the intergenerational time or the incubation period is 3.5 days.
Yeah.
So it goes, you know, let's say two cases to the eighth power, to the eighth power, to the eighth power, to the eighth power. I'm afraid that the Delta variant of COVID is the most infectious disease we have seen in living memory and maybe even before that. So herd immunity keeps moving away the more transmissible the disease is. I think we're going to have to find a way in addition to mass vaccination to control COVID, and we can talk more about that. We will control COVID. It has become endemic. We will have to find ways to live with these new variants. It's not always going to be like this, I want to say to your listeners. It's not always going to take all the oxygen out of the air. It's not always going to be the first thing you see on cable news. It's not always going to be the first thing that Jesse wants to talk to somebody in Mill Valley, California about.
Are we wasting our time trying to eliminate this variant from New Zealand then?
No, you have, besides a great prime minister, you have a wonderful advantage. You've got an island. If you have an island and you test people when they arrive, as we were doing for a while in Hawaii, that worked really well, even though it's not a country, as they did so well in Taiwan for most of the time, then you've got an inherent advantage because you can exclude the virus from your island by knowing that somebody who's arriving has it and then isolating them. It's a pretty straightforward matter. You could even have them tested before they get on the plane and then when they get off the plane. So you'd have two tests of a, you know, really good test, not an antigen test, a PCR test. If you could do that, you could make sure that nobody would bring the disease onto the island. And not a lot of other places have that. Iceland has been able to do that. Taiwan was able to do that. Singapore, which is sort of an island, was able to do that. But big land masses like the United States and Europe cannot do that.
Larry Brilliant, one of the most respected epidemiologists in the world. He was on the WHO team that eradicated smallpox, and we're chatting to him, of course, about COVID-19. What is your view as to why there is so much suspicion about a vaccine? We've been taking vaccines for polio and for, quote, your disease, smallpox, for decades and decades. What's going on out there?
Well, the first vaccine ever given was the smallpox vaccination. It was originally cowpox. And in Latin, the name cow is vacca. So vaccination is really literally giving somebody a dose of cowpox. Wow. So you're always giving somebody a cow. You can tell them that instead of a vaccine. But that was 1797. I would think that the anti-vax movement probably began in 1798. Almost immediately afterwards, because it was preposterous to take pus from the finger of a milkmaid. And that was what was done. Sarah Nelms was her name. History has recorded her name. And history recorded the name of the cow, Blossom. So Blossom had an infection on her udder of cowpox. Sarah Nelms milked the udder and got the infection spread to her finger. And then Edward Jenner, the local physician, scraped some of that pus off and then inserted it into a scratch on the arm of a young boy named Phelps. And that boy was then sent out into the market where there was lots and lots of smallpox, and he didn't get it. And so that's, I would say that's a heavy lift to believe in that. I would, it's pretty easy if you were a mother of a kid and they said, you know, I'm going to put pus from the udder of a cow in your boy or girl, and they're going to be immune to smallpox. That wouldn't make sense. So I probably would have been an anti-vaxxer myself then. But we've now had hundreds of years of success. We've eradicated smallpox because of that vaccine. I saw the last case of smallpox in nature, a little girl in Bola Island named Rahima Banu. When her disease ended and her scabs fell and her cough ended, that was the end of an unbroken chain of transmission of smallpox. It went all the way back to Pharaoh Ramses, killed billions of people. God, thank God. I mean, we should be in awe that a vaccine saved that many more billions of people from getting it. We're really close to eradicating polio. There's only really one country in the world, Pakistan, that is a problem and has some cases, and Pakistan is doing really well. Hopefully soon we'll have Pakistan completed, and then we'll have polio eradicated. So we couldn't have done that without great vaccines. But there's always been a reaction against vaccine, which has been greater than against medicines. And that should be understandable. We shouldn't feel that people who are anti-vax are our enemies. Look, vaccines are different because you're giving them to healthy people to prevent something. Sick people, when you give them a medicine, it's easier to understand that while we may disagree about which medicine, we won't disagree that we have to give them something. It's difficult, I think, to really wrap your mind around the fact that you're going to stick something into somebody who isn't sick, risk them getting a reaction in order to prevent something that's odorless and tasteless and invisible. But let me just say one more thing, though. These vaccines that we have produced in less than a year, setting the world speed record for vaccines, they're the best vaccines we've ever had. They're not a science project, as some people think, when we only tested them on 30,000 people in November. You might have thought that. But we've now inserted them in doses of over 5 billion. And we're not finding people dying. And with all respect to an American musician, a young woman who's a music star, I've not seen anybody who got the vaccine who had their testicles explode. I mean, you know, that's what she tweeted. That's what she tweeted to her 27 million followers. That kind of misinformation is not right. It's not fair. We've got kids who are going to school. They're too young to get vaccinated. They're surrounded by people who may not have been vaccinated, may not have been tested, may not be wearing masks. We've got to protect those kids. It's really wrong to spread misinformation that makes people think that, you know, they're going to have sexual problems if they take the vaccine. That's just not true. So I hope that everybody listening will get vaccinated. I hope you'll get full doses of the vaccine, whichever you choose and whichever is available to you. I'm very pleasantly surprised at how few side effects there are. When you think about injecting anything, even water, into 5 billion people, I might have expected some more untoward effects. And I'm thrilled that even now, after this horrific variant, the Delta variant, these same vaccines are preventing you from getting sick, getting in hospital, getting put on a respirator, and getting dead. That's the most important thing. They still work. They work well. Very low percentage of side effects. I would say something different if that were the case. I'm not in the business of selling vaccines. I'm in the business of stopping epidemics.
You are. Can you describe what it feels like to be part of a team that rids the world of something as awful as smallpox?
Well, I cried like a baby. I mean, all of us did. I was part of a team of about 10, half Indians and half internationals, and we went door to door. Well, we had 150,000 of our closest friends who were also working door to door in India. We made 2 billion house calls every month. When I showed up in India as a young kid, fresh out of medical school, there were 250,000 babies with smallpox. I went into villages where there were dead bodies laying like stacked like cords of wood. And then less than 3 years later, that disease didn't exist anymore. I mean, it's turned me into an eternal optimist that human beings, if we get out of our own way and we get our act together, we can do so much wonderful thing. I don't really know why or how we've turned masks and vaccination into political talismans and icons. I think if we have a moment to reflect soberly on what it means to think of a mask as a mark of a political party, what is it, Zorro? I mean, it's a crazy thing. We've gotten our knickers in a twist, I think, in a way, way, way too confused. A vaccine is not an instrumentality of oppression. A vaccine is an instrument of liberation. If people are vaccinated, we can go back and hug our friends and meet at least outdoors without masks even. And the combination of vaccines and masks means we are free to do whatever we want to do. I want to go to rock concerts again. I want my kids to be able to have an ordinary youth and not be stuck inside. We're being stuck inside, and public health people will have to overreact if there's not adequate vaccination and mask wearing, if the disease gets out of hand, if the isolation facilities are full up, as they are in 12 U.S. states. There's just no more room at the inn. If you need to go to an ICU because you've got a heart attack or a difficult childbirth, or you've got to get chemotherapy. You know, one guy had to go over 140 hospitals, got to get contacted before he could find anyone who would let him in for an ECMO treatment, one of the most extreme treatments for COVID. Somebody else went 40 different hospitals in Alabama in order to get a bed for a heart attack because they were all filled up with COVID patients. It's not a harmless thing to not get vaccinated. You have to think about the effect that you have on yourself, on your family. So I'm a public health person. You know, I understand having the word public in it may signal some political allegiance. It doesn't. To me, public means everybody. I just would like to see us knuckle down, get the politics out of the way, get the craziness out of the social media realm, and let's get cracking.
There was a scramble to get vaccinated during this latest outbreak, get vaccinated to protect myself and then get my family vaccinated. And then people realise, well, actually, probably the whole city or country needs to have a good level of vaccination. You call for thinking a step beyond that, which is think about the girl in Bangladesh, that actually her being vaccinated is kind of important to your own future. It's a global problem and a global solution.
I'd even take a step beyond that. I mean, look, we have 7.5 billion people in the world. To start off, everybody's going to need 2 doses. They're probably going to need a 3rd dose. Now you're in the 22 billion doses. You're probably going to need that every year. It's probably going to take 3 years or more to get rid of this disease. You know, we're talking about 30, 40, 50 billion doses. And it's absurd to think that 1 or 2 factories or 1 or 2 companies can manufacture that many doses. I think we have to export vaccine factories, export the know-how to make vaccine producing lines and facilities all over the world. There should be 50 or 100 places and countries that can manufacture their own vaccines. We should share that knowledge. I don't care if the big pharma companies get royalties. I hope they could make more money exporting factories than they do exporting vaccines. I don't care about that. What I know, having worked on the polio eradication program, the vaccine and the smallpox eradication program, both of which were big global vaccination programs, the hardest part is not making the vaccine. The hardest part is not even manufacturing and getting it to the capital cities of 200 countries. The hardest thing is once you've got it in the capital cities, how do you get it to the outback? How do you get it to the last mile? How do you get it to the most remote island, to the most remote village that's off the beaten path? And unless we are able to get it everywhere and vaccinate everyone, this virus will continue to spread. It will continue to make variants. I mean, to me, it's simple. We either export vaccine factories or we'll import from variant-making factories the next variant, and this process will keep on going. I don't think we're thinking straight. We may want this to be a different thing than it is. It's the most contagious disease of our lifetimes. It's spinning off variants. Vaccines will, in due course, have waning immunity. There will be new variants. I think we have to take it really seriously and be ahead of it. And you can do something different on an island in New Zealand than the rest of the world can do. You can keep the virus out. Most of the world can't do that. So we've got to figure out how to prevent it from going to its next customer. We've got to eliminate the market for the virus to sell its terrible, noxious product to the next customer by vaccinating everybody.
I've been speaking to Dr. Larry Brilliant, founder and CEO of Pan Defence Advisory. It's a pandemic response consultancy. Larry was on the team from the WHO that eradicated smallpox, and he's one of the most respected epidemiologists in the world. I'm so grateful for your time today. Thank you.
Oh, Jesse, thank you for inviting me, and let's get together at a non-Dickensian moment.